Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Mike Pence will formally accept the Republican nomination for vice president tonight. He has been a faithful, smiling, sunny foot soldier for President Trump for the past 4 years. If Trump wins re-election, what would Pence's role be for the next 4 years? And what is the case he'll make tonight to be able to be given a chance to do that? So this hour on Point, Vice President Mike Pence and his importance to the Republican now and in the future. We'll start today with Michael D'Antonio. He's co-author of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. He's also a CNN contributor as well. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
So first of all, how would you characterize Mike Pence's 4 years thus far as vice president? What kind of vice president has he been?
Well, you know, I would say that he's been exactly who Donald Trump wanted him to be. Mike is very, very good at adapting to whatever environment he finds himself in. And I think that it's important to keep in mind that he's pursuing his own ambition, even as he walks this tightrope of trying to be an effective vice president, an effective public servant, but also trying to stay in Donald Trump's good graces. And he's done that very, very well. So this man that we see praising him at cabinet meetings and actually extending his lies as he goes around the country to downplay the risk of the pandemic and praise the president is exactly who we'll see should the team get reelected in 2020.
So about that ambition part, I'd like you to help us understand sort of more deeply Mike Pence, the man, because as you said, he does present or is, I should actually say, very loyal to the president. He has been unfailingly sunny, standing by his side. But I don't want to use the word masking, but underlying that is this other, this deeper ambition for himself. So go back in time with me, Michael. I mean, how long has Mike Pence had great dreams for himself, for his political career?
Well, I can peg it almost exactly at age 15 or 16. Mike Pence in high school let it be known to his friends that he thought he should one day be president. And although a lot of kids, and especially little boys and girls, might say in elementary school, when I grow up, I want to be president, in Mike's case, this was something that he first expressed at that age, and I think has been pursuing ever since. And this is neither good or bad when you look at this fairly. You know, he had every right to the ambition that he held. But his pursuit has been, I think, especially careful. You know, this is a person who knows how to chase his dreams and pursue his goals without appearing to be grasping. And that's might be what people would describe as kind of the Hoosier way. They're very neighborly people. You know, this is an Indiana-born and bred guy who really identifies with that spirit. And so this sunny demeanor that he offers, I think by now is quite genuine, but it's also something that's practiced and that he's cultivated carefully.
Well, I mean, to your point, anyone who runs for a political office at any level, but especially at the highest levels, is de facto ambitious. And there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I suppose the question for someone like Vice President Pence is, because his how he identifies and the depth of his of the importance of his faith in his life, how that his ambitious path goes through a Donald Trump presidency is really the question. So can you remind us, you know, four years ago, what was do we know what Mike Pence's first thoughts were about serving alongside a man like Donald Trump?
Well, from what I understand, he was enthralled by the opportunity. I think that he saw this as a unexpected turn in his career. He was facing the very real risk of being defeated if he ran for re-election as governor of Indiana. He was a one-termer who was kind of middling chief executive of the state. He managed things fairly well, but committed a lot of mistakes. His popularity ratings were down. I know that Mrs. Pence was quite apprehensive about tying their future to this association with Donald Trump. And there's no doubt that Trump, as a person, represented kind of the opposite of Mike Pence. So in Trump, you have this thrice married man who's extremely profane. I don't know if he showed that in his meetings with Mike, but he lies almost as readily as he speaks. And that's something I think that probably made Mike uncomfortable. I think especially his behavior around women would make Mike uncomfortable. But there's this overarching goal that is partly political and partly religious, to bring a conservative sort of evangelical right-wing perspective to government. I think he saw Donald Trump as the vessel for that. And I think that events have proved him to be right. So, you know, he definitely would say this is where God placed him, and pursue the alliance very aggressively once he decided to make it.
Well, let's listen back to the current vice president's 2016 nomination acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, again in 2016 in Cleveland.
We have but one choice, and that man is ready. This team is ready. Our party is ready. And when we elect Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States, together, we will make America great again.
So I want to introduce now into the conversation Whit Ayers. He's a Republican pollster and president of North Star Opinion Research. Whit Ayers, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. So, first of all, remind us, in terms of President Trump's, or that then-candidate Trump's, ambitions for the presidency, how important was Mike Pence to him back in 2016?
Mike Pence was a critically important component of the Trump campaign in 2016. He is, as Michael has said, a very sincere religious conservative. And he reached out to evangelicals on behalf of Donald Trump. I think the list of conservative judges crafted by Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society and Mike Pence's presence on the ticket gave evangelicals a measure of comfort that they would never have had otherwise with Donald Trump. But beyond that, Mike Pence was a great link to the House Republicans, where he served for a dozen years, as well as to the governors around the country because of his service as Indiana governor. He also had better links than Donald Trump did to some major Republican donors like the Koch brothers. So across an array of coalition members, Mike Pence was a really critical component of that campaign.
I see. So regarding those evangelical voters, now they've had 4 years with the presidency of Donald Trump. And it seems to me that is the necessity of that bridge that the vice president provided to that community, is it as necessary anymore? Because it seems that it's those very voters that have crossed that bridge and are very supportive of Donald Trump himself.
They surely are. But it certainly would not send a good signal if Donald Trump were to jettison the most prominent religious conservative in his administration. That would not send a good signal. So I think he remains a very important component of the Trump appeal to religious conservatives.
Mm-hmm. And what about for the Republican Party as well, as it considers its future, whether it be under another 4 years of a second Trump presidency, but even beyond that, like what kind of figure is Mike Pence for the GOP now and going forward?
He clearly has presidential ambitions. But then that's not saying much, Magna. I'm convinced that all 50 governors and all 535 members of Congress look in the mirror in the morning and see a president. If Donald Trump gets reelected, then you'd have to think that Mike Pence would have the inside track to the Republican nomination in 2024. On the other hand, if Donald Trump loses in November, then I think Mike Pence would join a cast of thousands for the Republican nomination with people like Marco Rubio and Nikki Haley and Tom Cotton and Tim Scott and Larry Hogan and Mike DeWine and Ted Cruz and on and on and on. So he will be one of many, many candidates if the Trump administration loses in November.
Right. We've just got about 45 seconds left with you, Whit. What do you think the vice president needs to say tonight as he makes his case for another 4 years as in the vice presidency?
I think he will say what he has always said, which is that Donald Trump is the better choice for America and Donald Trump is a better choice for conservative Americans.
Well, Whit Ayers is a Republican pollster and the president of North Star Opinion Research. Whit, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Magnum.
And Michael D'Antonio, hang on here for just a second. We've got a lot more to talk about. We've got to take a quick break, but we are talking about Vice President Mike Pence, what it's been like with as 4 years of vice president, what his ambitions are for the future. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's day three of the Republican National Convention, and tonight, Mike Pence will formally accept the nomination for the vice presidency. And so we're talking about Vice President Pence today, his record over the past 4 years in the Trump administration, and his ambitions beyond. And we're joined today by Michael D'Antonio. He is a CNN contributor and co-author of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. And Michael, I'd like to hear a little bit more about faith and the story of Mike Pence's Christianity. And first of all, let's just hear a little bit more from Pence himself. He spoke at Liberty University's commencement in 2019, and here's a little bit what he said.
You know, throughout most of American history, it's been pretty easy to call yourself Christian. Didn't even occur to people that you might be shunned or ridiculed for defending the teachings of the Bible. But things are different now. Some of the loudest voices for tolerance today have little tolerance for traditional Christian beliefs. So as you go about your daily life, just be ready.
That's Vice President Mike Pence in 2019. Now, Michael, Pence wasn't always, he started off his religious life as a Catholic, is that right?
Yes, he was a pretty typical heartland Catholic. His mother is of Irish descent, his father is of German descent, and I think that he was raised in the church, he was an altar boy. In his hometown of Columbus, there were really two main religious streams, and one was a sort of conservative evangelical stream, and that was a larger group of people, probably the dominant group. But the Catholic Church in Columbus was vibrant, and he was very much a part of it.
And so then what drew him to Christianity, evangelical Christianity?
Well, he went off to attend an evangelical university, and I think there he had also this impulse for leadership. And in that environment, it was almost fated that he would drift toward evangelical Christianity. I recall that he attended a music festival where people were called to profess their faith, and he felt that this had this a spiritual experience there. He was moved to a kind of conversion. And by the time he was a sophomore, he was a leader in this community. He actually held weekly prayer and study sessions in the chapel. People who attended college with him remember him as a very passionate evangelical by that time, although it took quite a while, probably 4 or 5 years, before he really expressed that identity and dropped his attachment to the Catholic Church.
Uh-huh. Well, and then for people who didn't know him before, of course, in 2016, he introduced himself to the nation as being a Christian first, right? He's a Christian, conservative, and then Republican in that order. So the centrality of his faith is all-consuming in his life. Does it drive everything, including those political ambitions?
Well, I think it's this exquisite blend of right-wing politics and a certain view of Christianity. You know, part of what you heard in that clip that you played is this idea that evangelical Christians in America are, in a way, victims, that somehow the world is against them and that they lack a certain, that they're not respected in the way that they hope they should be. But really, it goes beyond that. I think that his ultimate hope would be for an America that is entirely conservative Christian, that is guided more by that view of the Bible than by anything else. It's a very fervently held ambition, but it is at base political. You know, this is applied Christianity to a political goal. And you know, Christianity has been used in this way for a long time, for centuries. And there's always this kind of line that leaders like Mike Pence walk between what they think is the Christian thing to do and what their ambition drives them to do. And the result can be a lot of conflict. You know, in Mike's attachment to Donald Trump, he's been required to bear false witness over and over and over again. But I think the notion that this is in pursuit of a higher goal is what justifies it in his mind.
Uh-huh. Well, Michael, hang on here for a second, because I just want to spend a couple of minutes with Mike Evans, who joins us now from Dallas, Texas. He's one of 25 evangelical advisors to President Donald Trump. Mike Evans, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, first of all, how do you look upon Vice President Mike Pence's years thus far serving in the Trump administration? What's your take on how he's done?
Well, the best way I can describe it is a meeting in the Oval Office with the president in our group. It was our first meeting, and And in the meeting, we said to the president, can we pray for you? And he looked at us and he said, let me tell you where all that began. He said, I went to Mike Pence and I asked Mike Pence if he'd support me. And he said, you know what he said? He told me to bow my head for a word of prayer. He said, I'm a New York real estate guy. I don't bow my head for, he said, but I bowed my head. And ever since I've been bowing my head, and he laughed. And he meant it. He meant it. As a matter of fact, when he said, yes, pray for me, but pray that God will give us, give me 16 years. And we laughed. We said, you can't get 16 years. He said, yeah, eight for me and eight for Mike Pence. And he laughed. He's got a real sense of humor. Listen, Mike Pence is the real deal. He's the real deal. He's authentic. And he had what evangelicals call a born-again experience. And you can see that in his life. I mean, he walks the talk in his face. I mean, you're not going to see Mike Pence sitting in a restaurant with another woman. He won't do it. He's very, very conservative.
Hmm. You know, you just heard Michael say that part of the how Mike Pence has had to serve in the role of the vice president to Donald Trump is we can see in his loyalty to the president, and that loyalty has either forced him or he's chosen to have to, for example, stand by the myths, the mistruths, and the lies that the president has said. And I'm wondering how that comports with the tenets of that very faith that you're talking about, that Pence, you know, that he walks the walk on that.
Well, in all due respect, I just want to, I've known lots of presidents, all the way back to Carter, and every one of them lie. I mean, there's no president in office that tells the truth all the time. As a matter of fact, they can't for national security reasons. A lot of times they have to intentionally mislead people. So I don't think you can put a moral clarity measurement on why evangelicals support Donald Trump and why Mike Pence support Donald Trump. Number one, let's talk about the pragmatic. I am my grandfather was a rabbi in Minsk, Belarus. His dad, Belarus, he was burned to death in his synagogue with 2,000 Jews. And you know what they said before they burnt them? Christ killers. They screamed Christ killer. So my life is combating anti-Semitism and supporting Israel. There's no president who's done more for the state of Israel than Donald Trump. Now, does that make me want to support him? 110%. And I think you have to understand the evangelicals, they're looking at the Supreme Court justices, they're looking at traditional family values, and they also are smart enough to know that, you know, listen, let me tell you about Ronald Reagan. I knew Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was two Ronald Reagans. There was a Ronald Reagan out in front of the camera who was humble and soft and charming. There was another Ronald Reagan in private that was cold. Jim Watts, Secretary of Interior, told me, James Baker said to me, if you want a friend, go buy a dog. Ronald Reagan doesn't want to be your friend yet. So this authentic president, warts and all, is in fact supported by the evangelical base because there are certain things we want to achieve.
So the ends justify the means. That's what I hear you
saying. No,
no,
it's not that at all. Number one, if you go in Mike Pence's house, you'll see books like J. Oswald Chambers, Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis. It's not end justifies the means. The question you want to ask first, are you electing a pope? Are you electing a pastor? No, you're not. And no pastor in our group has perfect people in their congregation. There's no perfect politicians. And anyone who says you're a liar needs to examine their own heart, because the scriptures say, if a man says he has not lied, makes God a liar. So nobody's perfect. This is a gentleman who happens to be Donald Trump 24 hours a day. Now, that presents a problem in the political world, because You don't see that type of thing. You see duplicity.
Mr. Evans, forgive me. You see duplicity. You don't see what? I'm a little confused.
Well,
forgive me.
The politicians don't. They're not authentic all the time. They put on the mystique of, and that mystique is a persona that's generally fake. It's not real. It's not who they really are. It's an act. It's Alexander Hamilton. It's Broadway. Donald Trump is Donald Trump 24 hours a day. If you like it, if you don't like it, by the way, that's one of the reasons evangelicals supported it. Not because they supported his immoral lifestyle before he was president, or they supported his whatever. They supported him because they said, number one, we know who this guy is. We really do. Number two, he believes in us. He believes in – this is the first president, by the way, that hasn't gamed us. Every president made the same promises to us that Donald Trump made, including Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush. None of them kept it. We didn't have access. Donald Trump has been the first president that truly built a bridge with the evangelical base. When you use the word advisor, it's not just a little theme. He listens to us, and sometimes we say some pretty tough stuff to him.
Mm. Well, final question, Mr. Evans. So what is some of the tough stuff that you have told the president?
Listen, I'm not going to say that on the air. When we're in private with the president, we speak truth to power. Now, in public, we're not going out there and doing that, but we know this man. He's flawed. He's not a perfect man. Absolutely correct. But the question is, evangelicals are traditional family value people. We support right to life. We support a pro-Israel stance, et cetera, et cetera. What are our options? Do you think we've got it in Hillary Clinton, or going to get it in Joe Biden? It's not going to happen.
Well, Mike Evans is one of 25 evangelical advisors to Donald Trump. He's also a commentator and a minister as well, speaking to us from Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Michael D'Antoni, let me turn back to you here. I found that to be really interesting because you hear in Mr. Evans there an immediate reaction to a question I didn't actually ask. We started talking about Donald Trump rather than Mike Pence. What does that indicate to you about how evangelical Christians are feeling right now, even of just about the vice president himself versus the president?
Well, I found that a very revealing comment because, this is the conflict within evangelical Christianity. And really, we have to say it's right-wing evangelical Christianity. There are millions of evangelicals who don't support Donald Trump, who are appalled by many of his policies, who are concerned for protecting the environment, who saw that dead child floating in the Rio Grande when her father was seeking asylum with her, and were heartbroken. And they look at the president's response to the coronavirus, which has contributed tens of thousands of deaths and led to this appalling outcome, and wonder what in the world is Mike Pence doing in the name of his faith? So Mr. Evans, as he was speaking, really revealed what it's all about. This is a brutal form of politics. It's got nothing to do with the example of Christ. It has everything to do with, can we get the people in power who will do what we want? And primarily, this is a culture war thing. The policy on judges is really about trying to return America to a 1950s or a kind of a fantasy of the 1950s. And Mike Pence holds that in his heart as well. So, you know, he's done so many things, like chairing the bizarre voter fraud commission that was formed by the president to somehow investigate this thing that doesn't exist, and labored for years to do it, and in the end produced nothing. But this was an example of how the fantasy is far more important than reality. And you don't study issues in a complex way. You apply what you believe to the situation. And if it's uncomfortable or difficult, you just lie about it. Donald Trump's lies now exceed 20,000. These aren't lies on behalf of national security. These are lies in the pursuit of his political views, his political ambition. And if anyone thinks that Donald Trump is a sincere Christian, they really have to think again, because there's nothing in his conduct that indicates that's true.
Well, we are talking about Vice President Mike Pence, the past 4 years that he has served in the Trump administration, the next 4 years if he's reelected to the vice presidency, and his ambitions beyond that as well. Michael, hang on here for just a second. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be back with more. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we will be talking about President Donald Trump himself, because, of course, it will be day four of the Republican National Convention. And we're going to focus and hear from specifically people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and whether or not they are going to once again cast their ballots for him and why or why not. So we want to hear from you as well. If you voted for President Trump in 2016, has he earned your vote yet again? Or if he hasn't, why hasn't he? How is your life different now than it was 4 years ago? Call us with your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, since it is day three of the Republican National Convention and Mike Pence is expected to formally accept the nomination for vice president, we're talking about Vice President Pence and his importance to the Republican Party and his ambitions beyond 2020. And I'm joined today by Michael D'Antonio. He's an author and a CNN contributor and author of The Shadow President. I should say co-author of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. Michael, there's something else that that we heard in the previous segment with Mike Evans that I wanted to ask you about, because Mike Evans very clearly said that what he feels that the Trump administration has really delivered for him has to do with those judges and Israel. And as an evangelical Christian, I was surprised, and maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but he didn't say other things that one might presume were core values. Like, should the president have delivered on, I don't know, childhood poverty, on keeping people alive in a pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. I was just wondering, has for this wing of evangelical Christianity, have their political goals really been distilled down to that small set of things about supporting Israel, about judges, and about abortion?
I think it has. You know, but you know, this has been the case for, well, about 40 years. You can go back to Jerry Falwell Jr.'s dad and the moral majority, and how he was the one who wedded evangelicals, or again, right-wing evangelicals, to the anti-abortion movement. Actually, in the 70s, polls showed that most evangelicals, including conservatives, were pro-choice. So this, again, you know, Falwell was primarily a political player, and the evangelical, conservative evangelical preachers that followed him as leaders have all been nakedly political in their ambition. And the idea is to play on the issue of abortion, to play on the issue of Israel and others, and then bring everyone along in this fervent pursuit of those goals. But the real important thing is to get access, and as Mike Evans was saying, to be one of those people who's in the room with the president speaking truths to them. And this perpetuates what's become a kind of infrastructure of conservative political activism, where there are these people who make great sums of money every year going around the country giving talks, demanding these rights for Christians that they already have, and then wielding power in Washington, being kind of power players. So the National Prayer Breakfast is an example of that. There's really not a powerful person in Washington who doesn't attend that annual breakfast. And it's a demonstration of the Christian right's power. But it is these cultural issues. But, you know, look at Jerry Falwell's son and the scandal that he's been caught up in. It's not about pursuing these things for some pure moral purpose. It's about pursuing them to gather votes together, deliver them to a candidate, and then once that candidate is elected, wield power.
Well, and so about that power, you've written about how Mike Pence has actually been a power player of sorts, or has garnered the attention of power players in Washington for quite some time. I mean, he was one of the original beneficiaries of the Club for Growth and the PACs associated with it. Can you tell me about that?
Well, this is another thing that Mike put, or I guess it was Whit Ayers put his finger on. He mentioned that Pence was able to connect Trump with the traditional funders of the Republican Party who were on the sidelines when he ran for president and really reluctant to give even as he was nominated. Mike was a prodigious fundraiser, and he was identified by the Koch brothers organizations in 2000, along with a kind of class of new politicians. Jeff Flake was one of them. And the idea was to find well-spoken, attractive people who believed in the Koch message, which was unfettered capitalism, very little regulation. You know, Mike Pence is a guy who famously wrote a column saying that smoking doesn't cause disease. And so he's quite willing to perform in service to these donors. And as he proceeded in his career, he went to Congress, never authored or wrote a specific bill, not one in his decade in Congress, but was by the end giving money to other candidates because his own PAC was so rich. And as soon as he arrived in Washington as vice president, he established another PAC for his own purposes. So this is a guy who really it's based around money and conservative Christianity and using that to consolidate power in Washington.
Well, you're reminding us of him writing about smoking is so interesting because his op-ed, recent-ish op-ed about stating that there wasn't going to be a second big wave of coronavirus infections also jumps to mind because a few weeks later there was. Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, that part of his record is really astounding because he's gone around the country repeating the president's lies and saying, you know, kind of patently ridiculous things about the curve being flattened and suppressed in states where it was actually rising. And we have to remember that this has lethal consequences. And I'm always stunned to hear politicians downplay the risk of coronavirus when it's killing their own constituents. But this happened in Indiana when Mike was governor. He had an outbreak of AIDS in the southern part of the state where people were pressuring him, even conservative sheriffs who were finding people who were HIV positive in their drug busts. And he dawdled on this. It took him weeks and weeks and weeks to respond. And during that time, hundreds of people became infected. And you have to think, well, where is the concern for the actual lives of living people? It's one thing to go around proclaiming this right to life anti-abortion strategy, but taking care of living human beings really is way down on the agenda for the Trump administration and Mike Pence.
Yeah. About that HIV/AIDS outbreak in Indiana, just to add a couple more details, he, as governor, resisted calls in 2015 to establish needle exchange programs, even though Republicans in Indiana were advocating for them at the time. And I'm remembering also that in one of the counties there, the only HIV testing center in the area had been a Planned Parenthood clinic, but that was closed because of state cuts supported by Pence. So people didn't even have an opportunity to learn if they had contracted HIV. So some of the things that happened about that HIV/AIDS outbreak that you're talking about in Indiana. Well, let's listen to a little bit more of the vice president talking specifically about abortion issues. This is, again, during his 2019 speech at Liberty University's commencement.
We live in a time when it's become acceptable and even fashionable to ridicule and even discriminate against people of faith. You know, it wasn't all that long ago that the last administration brought the full weight of the federal government against the Little Sisters of the Poor, merely because that group of nuns refused to provide a health plan that violated their deeply held religious beliefs. And when the state of Georgia recently was debating legal protections for the unborn, a bevy of Hollywood liberals said they would boycott the entire state.
Vice President Mike Pence last year at Liberty University. Well, I want to bring into the conversation now Sarah Cliff. She's an investigative reporter for the New York Times who covers health policy and the American healthcare system. And she's followed Vice President Pence's track record on women's health. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So how would you describe what that track record is?
It's very strong. I mean, Vice President Pence has really been focused on abortion for as long as I've known him in politics. And he's been particularly focused on Planned Parenthood, which, you know, became a really big focus of the Republican Party, you know, in thanks to a lot of his urging. I remember interviewing him almost a decade ago at this point when he was a member of Congress and kind of starting to lead this nascent effort to defund Planned Parenthood, which ended up becoming a really big priority, part of the Republican Party platform. So pro-life activists really see Mike Pence as a tried and true advocate for their cause. They feel like he has been committed to it, that he is advancing new ideas, and that he is someone who really deeply cares about this particular issue and has shown that in every position of leadership that he's been in. Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that you're saying this, but when you know, we sort of introduced this portion of the conversation as Pence and women's health, and we immediately went to abortion, right? but of course, abortion is not at all the totality of of women's health, right? So has the vice president shown equal concern or care for other major issues around women's health? You know, breast cancer, about nutrition, about family supports, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one, honestly, that comes to mind is the Affordable Care Act, which is the law that's providing health insurance to millions of Americans. And, you know, that law is not specific affects women and men pretty significantly, having more access to either free or subsidized health insurance. And there are a lot of health benefits in that that are specific for women. One of the things that drafters of the Affordable Care Act did is required coverage of things like preventative mammograms, birth control, which has been quite controversial, and other screenings. And Vice President Pence, when he was a member of Congress as vice president, has been a pretty strong advocate for repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. So I don't think you see as much of an effort to expand women's health benefits. If anything, you see, particularly with the work on the Affordable Care Act, an effort to roll some of that back.
Well, and the impact, if it were indeed to be rolled back, would have, as you're saying, this a huge impact on women. I mean, there are protections in there for leave, for example, mm-hmm. that if it went away, I think it's pretty safe to argue that women would be disproportionately impacted.
Yeah. Another thing that kind of comes up is that before the Affordable Care Act, women often paid higher insurance premiums than men, or health insurance plans wouldn't cover pregnancy as a benefit because it's so expensive. All those rules have kind of evened the playing field. Now insurers can't charge women more. They have to cover pregnancy. That probably raises premiums a little bit for men, lowers them for women. So if you did repeal the Affordable Care Act, and this is something, you know, the Trump administration doesn't talk about it that much right now, but they are currently fighting in federal court to repeal the Affordable Care Act, you would see women uniquely disadvantaged by the disappearance of some of those provisions.
Yeah, including provisions specifically about pregnancy, maternity, newborn care. You've reported on all of that, Sarah. You know, what I also was going to ask you about is in the vice president's focus on abortion, for example, these other aspects of, let me just say, and his focus on Planned Parenthood, these other aspects of women's health, breast health, et cetera, mm-hmm. are services that in many places women could only get through Planned Parenthood. But that doesn't seem to have shifted the vice president's view on Planned Parenthood because of abortion.
No, it hasn't. And you kind of, these are the two sides you hear of this debate over Planned Parenthood constantly. When you hear someone like Vice President Pence talk about it, he'll focus on the fact that they are the largest abortion provider in the country. And that in his view, if they are going to be doing that business, that they should not be in the service of getting any sort of government dollars. The flip side of that is, if you do look at the academic research that's been done in this space, there really aren't enough clinics to fill the gaps that Planned Parenthood would leave behind if all of their clinics closed. And the things they are providing are a lot of STD screenings, you know, different kinds of birth control. There has been a lot of focus on what exactly their services are, how necessary they are. But there are a lot of places where Planned Parenthood is really the only place women are going to be able to get affordable mm-hmm. preventive care. But Mike Pence has done a really good job of advancing his agenda against Planned Parenthood in the White House. You know, this is something conservatives tried to do during the Obama administration, essentially kick Planned Parenthood out of the Title X fund, which pays for women's preventative care. And they were blocked again and again. But he was able to accomplish that, you know, during his tenure. And I think conservatives see that as a pretty big win, not having those funds going to Planned Parenthood anymore. But that, as you said, raises the question of are these services that Title X was funding, and Title X does not pay for abortion, it pays for mm-hmm. other women's healthcare services. What happens to the women who are relying on those services?
Yeah. Well, Sarah Cliff, investigative reporter for The New York Times, thank you so much for joining us today. And Michael D'Antonio, I'm afraid, Michael, even though I wanted to have a chance to give you the last word, I've just flat run out of time here. So I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. Michael's the co-author of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.